I'm very happy to have with me a friend of mine who is a person that has done pioneering work in the field of family systems. His name is Terry Kellogg. He's in the audience tonight, and I'm going to be inviting him up here after a while to talk about the subject that we'll be dealing with tonight, which is what I'm calling the most common family illness, or the most common family disease, or the most common systemic disorder, which, for lack of a better word, we'll call people addiction. We've been talking about all kinds of addictions and all forms of compulsivity. And we said that compulsivities were pathological relationships with mood-altering events, experiences, or things that had life-damaging consequences. And we talked about the whole range of things that you could be addicted to and how compulsive addictions are acted out in family systems and how they create dysfunction in family systems. And that my thesis has been that it's not just alcoholism, although thank God alcoholism is really being treated and looked at and advances are being made in alcoholism treatment, but that it really is that it's the tip of the iceberg. It's really sort of the alcoholic family or the drug addiction that we're experiencing is helping us to understand how compulsive we are as a people, and that basically what that's all about is being driven by something outside of ourselves, the belief that happiness lies outside of me, that I can find happiness if only I can find something outside of me. And that what I suggested in the very first program is that the crisis of the family is that people have a wrong perception of themselves, that people are shame-based. That is, that people really don't have a sense of their own selfness or beingness, and that consequently we make wrong decisions because of this wrong perception of ourselves, and that that gets carried on from generation to generation, that the sins of the fathers are indeed experienced by the children in the third and fourth generations. And that this is a terrible crisis. And it's a crisis because often what we refuse to do is really look at the delusions and what Ibsen called the vital lies of our families. The vital lies. The way we keep the family secrets. And we don't talk about what's going on in the family. And we saw that very poignantly when we looked at the sexually abusing family and the boundaries that exist around those families. Just this past week, a person was in one of the workshops that Terry Kellogg has designed and been a pioneer in, and she got in touch with sexual abuse 35 years later. And that yesterday in my office she kept saying to me, "Now everything makes sense. Now everything makes sense." Can you imagine the power of that ego defense, that dissociation out of that terrible violence that was done to her? And that is the most severe form of abuse, but what we've been looking at are all the other forms of abuse. And what I hope more than anything is that when this series is over, that most every human being watching it can identify themselves in this material. So that we stop talking about addicts and alleys, we stop talking about them, and we realize it's us. It's us as a people who have a problem, and we have a severe problem, and it's a problem that begins right in our families. So we've talked about abuse being a setup for compulsivity, neglect, emotional neglect. I went through all the basic needs and showed you how, when those get neglected, how severely damaged a person is. And how you have to adapt to survive when you can't get your needs met. and how the whole system will adapt to survive in order to try to get its needs met. You see, the human organism is incredible. We're perfect as an organism. And if you can't get your needs met in one way, you get them met in another way. But we get our needs met somehow. And the addictions are ways we get our needs met. Or I talked about the little kid in the family who gets all the attention for messing up. It's better to have bad breath than no breath at all. That's a basic need. Strokes are to the psyche what food is to the body. You can't get good ones, you go for bad ones. If you're dying of thirst, you'll drink muddy water. So if we don't begin to understand that these issues, this soil that is our families, creates societies, and it's encoded in the people in the societies. Now tonight we want to talk about people addiction, and we've already been talking about that. We've talked about alcoholism, we've talked about sexual addiction, eating disorders, and we've talked about the people in the family and how they get impacted by it. We've talked about workaholics and rageaholics and sadaholics, and all the ways you can get addicted to emotions or activities, and how that stresses the whole system, and how people's boundaries then become enmeshed. That because we don't have a soil, and the gardeners are not presenting a soil within which we can grow and get our needs met. Remember what I talked about, the healthy family, and we talked about the togetherness principle and the individuating principle. We talked about the need to conform and the need to individuate, the need to self-actualize and the need to belong to the group, and that polarity is always going on in families, and that we want to look at that. And then I talked about in the program on the dysfunctional families how you get the individuating, that is when walls are built up, and then this fusion where everybody gets confused in their identity. The whole family gets confused because the boundaries are fused. Or the old Gestalt people call this confluence, where everybody flows together. We agree not to disagree. But really, this chart visually shows how you lose your reality. And that somehow the system takes over the reality. That mama represented by the red and daddy by the black and one of the kids by green, another by orange, another by blue, have very little bit of their reality left by the time the system gets set up. And so that lost self, who am I? These people are all adapting in one way or the other. Now, we've already looked at some of the ways the people adapt. We looked at this dysfunctional family. This daddy is addicted to alcohol, he's addicted to drugs, he's addicted to work, he's addicted to power, to sex, to food, to religion, to rage. He's addicted to all of those things. And then the codependent, this person, this wife, is addicted to this addict. But this is a codependency. That is, she allows his addiction to go on. In a lot of the relationships we'll see, one person covers up for the other person. They put them to bed at night. They allow them to maintain their addiction. I was working with a family the other day where the mama is a hypochondriac. She's addicted to being sick and feeling bad. And everybody in that system enables her. They enable her. The husband doesn't go in there and say, "Get out of that bed. Let's go to town." One day, he just walks around walking on eggs, and it allows her to stay sick and allows her to continue her addiction. We saw that this person then gets her needs met through the children, through work, through volunteer work, through religion, through being righteous. See, a lot of times I'll say to people, what's the payoff? What's the payoff in this relationship? You just described a horror story of living with a guy for 18 years. What do you get out of it? What do you mean, what do I get out of it? And then I began to get, well, I'll tell you, and I'll change some of the pieces, but this client some years ago hid all night in a bathroom to catch her husband in bed with somebody. This was the ninth time she had done this. And when I said to her, don't you see some kind of pattern here? You don't have to be real bright to see a pattern. She said, well, no greater love than this, if anyone, they lay down their life. You see this, and I want to really, really underscore that, because sometimes people really get confused by that kind of religious doctrine, or they deny, they use it as a form of denial. But this person loses their reality, literally, by living with this person. Then the rest of the system, now again, for any of you who may have just tuned in tonight, remember that when one part of this mobile is affected, all the parts are affected. So you can begin to see that every part of this system gets affected by the addiction of this father, that all the kids are affected by it. And everybody in this system becomes addicted to the father's addiction, or becomes a codependent, or some people call the children paradependents. What I'd like you to see tonight is that usually people who become codependents were paradependents. That is, when we begin to look at the findings of the adult children of alcoholics, 50% of women who come from alcoholics fathers marry alcoholics. Very interesting that, and we think, did this happen to her because she's married to this addict, or did she already come into this set up for addiction herself and addiction to people? So once that system is affected, all the people are in it are affected. And then we talked about the kinds of roles. I talked about my roles of being a surrogate spouse, of being my father's father. They called him the block off the old chip in the AA clubs. And I was my father's father. I was my brother's father. And once I'm in those roles, I can't have my reality. I don't have any reality then. And there are feelings bound up with those roles. There's anger bound up with those roles. When you don't get your needs met. Remember I talked about an emotion as an energy in motion? And that, what are the emotions there for? In the program we did on the healthy family, the emotions are there to tell you whether you're getting your needs met or not. When all your needs are getting met, you're joyous. But you see, when my needs are not getting met, my anger comes up. And that's the signal. It's like the oil gauge on the car telling me that something's wrong with my system. It's not functioning. My needs are not being met. That I'm giving up my reality to be a surrogate spouse or a father of my brother at age 11. And so my reality, and then I became a scapegoat, I became an addict, I became a hero when I went to study to be a priest. There were just all these roles that I was carrying out of that system. And it took me a whole long time and a lot of pain. December the 11th, 1965, I sobered up from alcoholism, and I stopped using alcohol. I stopped that addiction, but I didn't stop the whole setup for addiction, compulsivity. And everybody in that system then becomes addicted to this system and carries this system, so that nobody, this lost self, this soul murder we've been talking about in this series, happens out of these family systems. So what we want to look at tonight is how all of these people are set up, and even this person is set up to be codependent. That is, to be dependent on people in order to get their needs met. The other thing I talked to you about is that the chief component of this family system is this husband and wife. If they come into this marriage incomplete, two half people, that makes a fourth. One half times one half equals a fourth. Both of these people are trying to get, so neither one of them can give. So the system simply can't get its needs met. The kids can't have a soil out of which they can get their needs met. Now, let's talk about people addiction. You can be addicted to a husband, or you can be addicted to a wife. We see cases where men will choose the same kind of woman over and over again, or a woman will choose the same kind of man over and over again. Probably counselor and therapist files are filled, at least if they don't know family system stuff, with women who marry a certain kind of male. I call it the wounded bird syndrome. And the woman finds this wounded bird, and she takes him and she nurtures him back to health. And of course, when he gets all healthy, he flies away. And she's sitting there wondering what happened, how did this happen? And I had a gal one time working with her. She had had something like 22 of these relationships. And I said to her, I said, well, what do you think's going on here? I mean, this doesn't take great sagacity to notice that there's a pattern here. She said, well, love is blind. Now, this is a piece of magic. This is a piece of magic. But it's also a way to keep this craziness going on. Or I talked to you about the gal who had married her fifth brutal alcoholic. Her father was a brutal alcoholic. These are serious addictions. And when Terry comes on tonight, I want him to, if he will, talk about that this is a primary kind of illness, just like alcoholism or drug addiction. These are primary illnesses, that what we're calling, for lack of a better word, codependency. Codependency really isn't a good word for this. I think people addiction is just good enough. Now, people get addicted to other people, or people get addicted to love relationships. That's a mood alterer. That's a wonderful mood alterer, because your boundaries collapse. And you have this oceanic feeling, and you're literally out of your gourd when you're in love. Somebody called it temporary psychosis, and it really is. But it's a wonderful feeling. You go back to the primordial, oceanic oneness of where you were with your mother, and especially those of us who were deprived narcissistically. Alice Miller's book, The Drama of the Gifted Child, just describes this magnificently. Now, people will seek for the rest of their life in drugs or some mood-altering phenomena like money or success or whatever, sex, something that really is euphoric, to go back to that primordial state. I wrote down some songs like said that we could literally do field trips to bars and listen to codependency as it's orchestrated on jukeboxes. Tammy Wynette, Stand By Your Man. I sang it. Stand By Your Man. No matter what, he can vomit on you. It doesn't matter. Stand by him, see? Or maybe he's lazy, maybe he's mean. He can come home as late as he please, but I can't help loving him. I can't help loving that man of mine. Or listen to some of these. The last blues song, Baby, Baby, Please Don't Go. I think I'm getting high, I'm feeling low. I told you about reading Oswald Spengler's The Decline of the West during my most depressed addiction period. I loved it. It attacked every known value. It was the most depressing thing I'd ever read, and I loved it. And when I taught at the university, I would teach Farewell to Arms, Hemingway, Faulkner's The Sound and the Fury. This was my course. You know, the poor people taking this course. She's my rock. She's the rock that I lean on. She's the sunshine of my day, and I don't care what you say about her. Lord, she took me in and made me everything I am today. See, this whole idea that someone else can make you happy. Good-hearted woman. She's a good-hearted woman in love with a good-timing man. She loves him in spite of his wicked ways that she don't understand. So this is sort of what I would call someone who is a man junkie. They're addicted to a certain kind of destructive relationship. And a book that has really gone in this culture is Women Who Love Too Much, Robin Norwood's book. I think it's a wrong title. I don't think it's about love at all. It's about addiction. And, of course, she is talking about addiction. But it isn't women who love too much. It's women who are severely addicted to a destructive kind of relationship. And then the other thing that we're really clear on, like in Los Angeles, in the program I run, we treat the parents in our drug program. What we find is that every single set of those parents is obsessing on their children. They're obsessive compulsive about their children when they come into the program. They're addicted to their kids. And that when we get them in treatment and finally get them going in treatment, every single one of those kids is acting out. Remember we talked about the kid acting out in order to keep the marriage together? So if mom and daddy get to obsess on the kids, they don't have to look at their marriage. They don't have to look at the problems in their marriage. Remember, compulsivities, addictions are distractions. There are ways to distract yourself. I didn't say this last week, but emotional abuse, which if you can't identify with the other, I can't imagine anybody not identifying with the stuff I went over in that program. at least some of it somewhere. And the idea is that we talk about depression as the common cold of mental illness or emotional illness. You see, what is depression? It's about loss. It's about sadness. It's about loss. So why is depression the common cold of mental illness? Because everybody lost themselves. What we've all done is lost ourselves, our reality. So if you stop long enough, if the workaholic stops, if we can get him stopped and quit getting him distracting himself with his work, or the vacuumaholic stops long enough to get in touch with her rage about her husband, or in my case, I was an intellectual in the university, and oh man, can you hide it, intellectualizing and probing cutting edges of abstractions. You don't have to deal with a feeling ever doing that kind of stuff. You can get away with it. You can be weird in universities and get away with it. Because that's all right, they're intellectuals and they're deep into, you know, heavy cutting edge stuff. So you don't have to deal with your feelings. Here's some of the stuff that Robin Norwood talks about. Typically, this is this woman who's addicted to this. You come from a home in which your emotional needs were not met. You've received little nurturing yourself, so you try to fill this unmet need vicariously by becoming a caregiver, especially to men who appear needy. By the way, men do this too. I see lots of men addicted to needy women. And the idea that you can be macho and strong if this woman is fragile and flawed, very common kind of phenomena. Because you were never able to change your parents into the warm, loving caretakers you long for, you respond deeply to the familiar type of emotionally unavailable man whom you can again try to change through your love. See the old dilemma that gets set up, that maybe if I just love... How do you get somebody who's emotionally not there for you to get them to love you? And if you get that set up, remember I talked about Piaget and the magical child? That gets set up magically. So what happens? You go out and you keep looking for emotionally distant people to see if you can work it out. And we wonder, how could this woman marry her fifth brutally beating her alcoholic when she saw her father hauled off to jail for beating up her mother? And she's been through 3 or 4 marriages. I mean, it's awesome to begin to see this addiction and how people literally give up their life. Terrified of abandonment, you will do anything to keep a relationship. Almost nothing is too much trouble, takes too much time, or is too expensive. See, this isn't love. What this is about is trying to do everything for somebody to manipulate them into loving you so they won't abandon you. It has nothing to do with love. It has nothing to do with spiritual growth and caring and nurturing somebody so that they can grow spiritually. It just enables them to be weak or whatever. Accustomed to lack of love and personal relationships, you're willing to wait, hope, and try harder to please. You're willing to take more than 50% of the responsibility. That book describes it very, very well, the extent of that problem. Now, in our country today, there is a program called the Adult Children of Alcoholics, but I think in time we're going to see the Adult Children of Workaholics. We're going to see the adult children of rageaholics, or maybe we can just all come together as Displaced Persons Anonymous. That's what I'm thinking of starting. Just people who, you know, we're all displaced persons. We've all lost ourselves. So if we could come together and share our experience, strength, and hope. Because what we've discovered in the profile, here's the profile that comes out of the adult children, but it's not... What I want you to hear, it's not just adult children of alcoholics. It would be the adult children of workaholics. They have difficulty in identifying their feelings. You're never allowed to have your feelings. Anger is one of the 7 deadly sins, so you can't have that. Sadness is being a weenie if you're a male. By the way, the sex roles are codependent roles. Real men are rational. Real women are intuitive. Real men are not nurturing and domestic. Real women are nurturing and domestic. Real men are not feeling. Real women are feeling. So I now pronounce you 2 in 1 flesh. So you get to use her intuition. She gets to use your rationality. Where do I sign the income tax? Do we get anything back, honey? See, this isn't health. These are 2 half people. It's like 2 people in a canoe. If one moves, the other one moves. Remember I talked about a healthy relationship, two people playing music together, or you become the custodians of each other's solitude? You become the custodian of that other person's reality. Goethe said, in a good marriage, we become the custodians of each other's solitude. That I'm there to care for your reality. That's what love is. Difficulty in expressing feelings, fear and denial of anger. I'm an adult child. My lip quivers when anger comes. Terrifies me. I'm almost phobic about it. I'm better now, as many will tell you. I'm doing better with it. But an inability to have spontaneous fun. See, for me, I had to get drunk. I could dance if I was drunk, but not drunk. It was the whole bottom tightened up, and it was this kind of number. Problem with close relationships, difficulty in adjusting to change, perfectionism, unrealistic expectations, lying when it would just be just as easy to tell the truth. Why? Because what have these kids seen? What have they seen? They've seen dishonesty all the way in these roles that their mother and father are playing. They don't know bottom line tolerance. They don't know what it is to live in a family where people are telling the truth, that the truth will make you free, that people are really saying what they feel and want and what they think instead of pretending like it's okay, it didn't bother me when it did. No knowledge of what functionality really is. This is what you've always known. It's sort of your bottom line deal. And so what do you know about what a healthy relationship is? Look for people to take care of. And then the most important kind of issue that we've been seeing over and over again is that deep sense of shame, that sense of worthlessness. I am worth less than. Now, somebody, Robert Stubbe, a director of the Family Systems, has defined this phenomena of codependency or people addiction as an emotional, psychological, and behavior condition that develops as a result of an individual's prolonged exposure to and practice of a set of oppressive rules. Rules which prevent the open expression of feeling. Why I like a definition like that is that it gets you out of, it isn't just in alcoholic families. It's wherever these rules are. The no talk rule. We don't talk about problems. Can I tell you how many people I've seen and in my, let's don't talk about unpleasant things. If you have something unpleasant to say, go to your room. So you go to your room and talk to the wall about unpleasant things. But there is no talking of unpleasant things in this family. There's a unbelievable movie called A Woman Under the Influence. It didn't get any press. But if that movie ever comes around, it's called A Woman Under the Influence. It's one of the most powerful movies that I've ever seen in terms of how a person gets set up for crazy making. And you watch the father at the dinner table controlling the conversation at the dinner table. What, let's talk about stuff, you know, and he decides what they'll talk about at the dinner table. And the wife's getting caught up in all this craziness and finally winds up being sent to an asylum. And you just begin to experience her loneliness and just the horror of what's happening to her because she can't be real in this system. So one of the rules is the no-talk rule. These are the rules I talked about when we talked about dysfunctional families. Communication is best if indirect. We need to take out the garbage. You know, we've never done that as a couple. It's not okay to be spontaneous. Spontaneity when the kids are jumping around and just being kids. See, we like these little robots that walk upstairs and they say, my, those children are well-behaved. When I was a high school teacher, I loved those little robot kids that were scared of me. And God, they'd do everything. They'd do all their homework and they'd turn it in. But they weren't real. They were sitting there pretending. They were terrified. You know, is that what we want? People who are terrified? It's not okay to be spontaneous. Don't be selfish. That is, do it my way. That's what that means. Anytime somebody tells you don't be selfish, they mean do it the way I want you to. Do as I say, not as I do. Don't be different or rock the boat. See, what about creativity? What about creativity instead of obedience and conformity and all that stuff? What about what makes the world what it is? People who did new things and were different. And you see the terrible problem when we have these enmeshed, conforming, rigid, obedient, oriented kinds of homes. How does somebody get creative? How do you get to do a new thing or just be yourself or go make bobsleds in Aspen because that's what you really want to do?
instead of always doing what the men in this family do. The individual exists for the family. Now, that is the most important point. I've made it over and over again, that the individual exists for the system. That's what enmeshment is about. That's what these roles are about. That is, in a dysfunctional family, the family is what's important, not the individuals. In a healthy family, the individuals are what's important. See, the sex roles, before you were born, this society is telling you how you're supposed to be. Suppose you're different than that. Suppose you're a little girl that snorts when you laugh. And they say, wait a minute, that's not ladylike. So already this society has decided how you're supposed to be before you're even born. So what about who I am and there's never been anybody like me and all that bull they told me growing up? It isn't bull, really, but it really, when you have a society that imposes the way a man should be, the way a woman should be, then you don't get to have your own reality. And that's what these rules basically do. See, Virginia Satir says they're not bad people, they're bad rules. These systems are bigger than all of us. Remember, this is not blame that we're talking about. It's assigning responsibility. It's us going back like archaeologists and trying to figure out what has happened and how we get to a state where we don't have our own reality in this one and only life we've got. That's what this is about. Okay? I want to stop at this point and introduce Terry Kellogg. Terry, can you come on up and welcome to the program and have a seat. Let me just say to my viewing audience that Terry Kellogg is a pioneer in this work. He is currently a consultant. He goes all over the country. He is doing for us here at the Center for Recovering Families. Mary Bell and myself are involved in work here in Houston, the Center for Recovering Families. Terry, about six times a year now, is going to do New Life Family workshops. We'll talk more about that next week in terms of the process. Terry has been a pioneer in understanding eating disorders, sexual addiction, all forms of compulsivity, and I consider you to be really one of the leading experts in the field, so I'm really pleased to have you here.
Thank you. Can I leave now?
Well, okay, but the thing that I'd hope tonight is that I could get you to perhaps give a little more in-depth some of the kinds of issues involved in codependency or people addiction or your own way of saying that.
Okay, one of the things about codependency, though, is it's hard to understand from the inside of it. It's like, it's wonderful to listen to someone else talk about theirs or to describe it, but when you're on the inside of it, it gets nebulous, it gets hazy. And I think we tend to see our addictions see the world through our addictions. You were talking about Robin Norwood's book, and I did a workshop with her. And she was selling her books at the workshop. And there was a woman that I knew who had an eating disorder. She was a compulsive overeater. And she bought that book believing that it said, women who love to munch.
So sometimes it
masks other things. But you said codependency is a people addiction. And it isn't that, because it makes all of our relationships destructive. But it makes them destructive because it's an overreaction to what's outside of us rather than to what's within. And in that overreaction to what's outside of us, we're trying to take care of other people's feelings or react to how they feel or what they want. And we'll notice when they're not living up to their responsibilities, but it's hard for us to define our own. And we may be over-responsible or under-responsible, but we don't have a definition of who we are, what we feel, and what we're responsible for. One step down the line, though, I think codependency is really more of a cultural phenomena than it is even an addiction. So I think that, you talked about women, women who love too much, women who are taking care of men, and I think there's a way that women are taught codependency. They're taught to put their feelings second, to look at taking care of other people's feelings, make people happy. A lot of families, that are getting ready to go out for the night. There'll be one person in the family that won't be ready because they've been helping everybody else get ready. And then they feel victimized by it and angry about it, and then they get martyred and the rest of the family gets angry at them because the family has to wait for them to get ready. See, that's the codependent.
I've heard you make the distinction between a learned codependency and codependency as an addiction. That would be a good one to...
All right, let's say that you're that person that's always helping everybody get ready. And so I say, gee, John, you know, you're never on time. There's a pattern here. You talk about patterns. And I say, maybe it's because you're spending too much time worrying about everybody else being on time. Why don't you just get ready sometime and let people find their own socks? And then you'd say, that sounds like a good idea. And then the next time you're going out, you're looking for socks and ties and suits and, you know, making everybody's got their teeth brushed and no lint anywhere in the neighborhood, and you're not ready. That's an addiction. Ah. If you say, oh, Terry, okay, I hear that, and then you go home and you change it, that's a learned behavior. See, a lot of us learn how to be in codependent relationships, how to behave codependently, and we can change that without treatment, without a recovery process. I think if it's an addiction, there is no recovery. That's a little depressing, but
yeah.
We work recovery programs, but we don't get over it. We have to learn to live with it.
And you can do something to stop the destructive aspects of it or consequences of it, but you have to keep working on it. That's
yes.
what you're saying.
Yeah. So okay. If you're mobile, that thing was in motion, I think, most of your talk. And when the stasis of the family, the dynamic homeostasis of the family, for a lot of us, is dysfunction. So as it sits, that's dysfunction. So we've got to keep it moving so that we can have functionality in our life. And that's a recovery process. And when we stop that recovery process, we're back to the mobile. We're back to the dysfunction.
Yeah. That's why I said one night it's not the best kind of way to illustrate it, because the wholeness of it as a work of art doesn't get the idea that it could be a sick family that just keeps staying that way.
Yes. And that's what we'll go back to. It's like alcoholics know that. When they stop working their program, they go back into their disease, wet or dry. They're back into it. And I think that's true for all of us if we've come from a dysfunctional family.
Yeah, you talked about it as being a primary, talked about alcoholism as primary. I haven't stressed that. Did you comment on that it's a primary illness when it's an addiction?
Okay. Yeah, alcoholism, we described alcoholism as primary, permanent, progressive, predictable, pervasive, and terminal. And everything that we say about alcoholism is also true for codependency. It's primary, permanent, progressive, predictable, and it kills people. And it's pervasive, affects everything in our life. And codependents smoke more, have more eating disorders, they have more stress and tension, more prone to heart disease and cancer, and so on. So we're going to die of it.
Yeah, I think that's a really powerful way to put it, that people don't think of it. Because again, you get caught up in this, well, look, I'm giving my life for somebody. How can you fault me? And I think, you know, as a theologian, there's been a lot of damage in the Judeo-Christian tradition of this helping. Mm-hmm. That's another place that people get set up for it.
Yeah, and like caregiving, it's good to care about people and to help people. But I think when it becomes caretaking and we give up part of ourselves without the joy of the giving, when you start resenting what you're doing, that's a kind of a red flag for codependency. You're taking care of other people and you're starting to resent it. Or you feel like a victim. People are doing things to you. Or you started getting called martyr, or you're in a martyr posture where you're giving up too much of your own life for others. Or you don't have boundaries. You know, you can't set limits on other people's behavior. Those are sort of the red flags of codependency.
That's nice to have some kind of signals like that, because I'm always having parents say, when am I getting into rescue with my kids? And I've used that kind of model too. When you're constantly doing something you don't want to do,
right,
or you're doing more than mom and daddy are laying there in the middle of the night, worried about little Farquhar's grades, and he's sound asleep. I mean, he's having a wonderful time. Or he's constantly leaving his books at school and you're rushing back to get them, and obviously then it's you're losing your own reality. What about boundaries, Terry? A lot of them, the questions that have come to me over the last weeks during this series, people say, well, okay, well, what about, how do I start building boundaries?
I don't think it's something we go out and construct sort of like a mesh cage around us necessarily. A lot of times people talk about boundaries as external, so the visualization of the boundary is there. The boundaries are internal. They're within us. And they really stem from a knowledge and acceptance of myself, a love of myself for who I am, a love of myself as a man. The biggest building of boundaries for me has been to get fathering, so I know myself and love myself as a man.
Okay, how have you done that?
Well, I didn't have a lot of fathering growing up because I came from an alcoholic system. And what I've done is I've met men like you that, you know, can care about and affirm and share ideas with and and somebody will pat me on the back after a talk, or I'll talk to a friend about cars, and I say, that man cares about me, is willing to listen, spend time with me, and loves me in that way. And the key is that I've had to give up my child dependency needs some. I had to grieve their loss. I've had to look at my adult dependency needs and let what's given be enough as an adult. And then I can begin to love myself as a man, I can begin to love others, and I can receive mothering in the same way. And then have healthy and respectful relationships with women and begin to love women as well. But those are, boundaries are built by our relationship with ourselves, and they're also built by the learning how to set limits. It's just simply saying no, allowing ourselves some space, saying no to kids coming into our bedroom, you know, borrowing our clothes. Because, you know, if I want to wear a shirt, my son says, I'd like to borrow your shirt, and I want to wear it, I say, that's my shirt. You know, and it used to be I'd give him my shirt, my coat, my tie, and anything else he wanted, because I didn't have any boundaries. I didn't have my own clothing. Now, some caring is, yes, if it's an important event for him, let him wear the shirt. You know, but if I'm going to resent it, then I have to take care of myself and keep them back. And then I teach him boundaries. Boundaries are taught by parents setting limits so that kids learn limits. That's how values are taught. Parents that have values teach the kids values.
Yeah, that's something that I've struggled with, and that Scott Peck talks about. I talked about that in this third program, the parents being disciplinarians, but they're undisciplined disciplinarians.
Mm-hmm.
They're unself-disciplined disciplinarians. So, yeah, I'll go in there and really give my kid hell and set the limits, and then I feel bad about it, and then let him walk all over my boundaries until I can't take it anymore,
mm-hmm.
and then go crazy. And that pattern in the early part of my parenting was very, very dominant before I really understood any of that.
Yeah, well, that was the same with me, and I think it was because of my own lack of development. Parents that haven't become adults can't afford to let their kids become adults. And so instead they enmesh with their kids, they hang on too tight to their kids, and teach their kids codependency. In fact, I think a lot of parents hang on to their kids so tight that a friend of mine is a doctor said the most common operation needed in our society is a parentectomy.
Yeah, I love that.
Kid has to be surgically removed. Okay.
Yeah.
So when we can start letting go of our kids, you know, they can become adults, but if we haven't been there, then we don't have our own reality, and we can't give them a sense of their own. We can't teach that. And the other thing is that a family where there are no boundaries, so no one is real enough to get close to. And so instead of getting close to people, you begin dependency issues with people. And so the dependency becomes an enmeshed reality, and that takes the place of closeness. But enmeshment, you don't have closeness. Your illustration says it clearly. You don't know who you are and who other people are and which finger belongs to which hand. You get smothered by other people's reality when you don't have boundaries.
Yeah, I love the work that you've been doing on intimacy and the issues of intimacy. I didn't say that as much tonight, but that's one of the things that comes out over and over again in people with this kind of problem, is they don't know how to be intimate.
Mm-hmm.
They either get enmeshed, they don't know how to keep a distance in relationships. And comment on that. You've really said, I've heard you say some beautiful kinds of things about that. The issues of intimacy and the tapes you've done on return to intimacy.
Mm-hmm. Well, back to the enmeshment, you know, people that are enmeshed are being smothered, and they don't have their reality, and they struggle within relationships, and that's the destruction of the relationship. And we don't know how to take care of ourselves within a relationship, we can't have a relationship, but eventually we get out. But when we're out, if we come from enmeshment, we have isolation. See, and that's a whole line of codependency is going from, you know, this, you know, it's a relief to be out, you know, but eventually it hurts too much and we go back in. And what codependents need to learn in their recovery is the intimacy where you have detachment. And the detachment is our wholeness and separateness as people. And then you can travel with relationship and have relationship even though I may be 2,000 miles away. I still have relationship and intimacy. And when I'm here, you know, I'm allowing the intimacy to build over a period of time, you know, by two people not face-to-face. Some face-to-face, yes, some love, some sex, you know, some sharing and caring. But a lot of it just builds by two people facing the world outside of themselves in the same direction. And I think that intimacy can build more from like losing luggage at an airport sometimes than the different types of sex you may be reading about and experimenting with.
Yeah, I love that way that you describe that. I know in my own life when I heard you talking about that one time of you and Gretchen looking for one of your kids, or your kid was going
to... Yeah, we lost our kid in an airport for 30 hours. As flying to London, and she was gone, and that built more intimacy in our relationship. It was a crisis, and then that brought us together. We were sharing that outside of ourselves.
I think that that's so important because people think of intimacy so often as either sexual, and a lot of sexuality is not intimacy at all.
Yeah.
It's just enmeshment, or it's addiction, or...
Yeah, the dependency and the sexuality can be substitutes for intimacy, but they can never help us define ourselves. In intimacy, we get the, that's the stewardship, the guardianship. We get to help in defining ourselves. And I think that any other kind of relationship where you don't get a clear definition of self is a destructive relationship, the codependency.
What are you recommending? Let's say people are watching tonight and they really start identifying with this. They realize they're in very destructive relationships or whatever. What are some kind of things you would say to them tonight?
One is that it's not something we're going to recover from. That it's, a friend of mine says that codependents are going to be in relationship with addicts or other codependents. Just like professional Monopoly players hang out with professional Monopoly players and not chess players because they don't know the rules of the game and which way the pieces move or what the pieces look like. And in that, I think as we get healthier, we're hanging out with recovering addicts or recovering codependents, or at least we're reacting more healthily to the addicts that are acting out that we're living with or in relationship with. That's what we have to learn how to suffer. So I think we have to teach codependents how to suffer, and that they don't suffer. But while suffering, they don't know how to suffer, and have that as a part of life. While suffering, what codependents do is they begin to define life as a problem to be solved, instead of a mystery to be embraced. And in the embracing of the mystery of life, there is suffering. We also have to teach codependents ourselves how to have a sense of humor, how to play, and have some detachment. The humor itself helps in detachment.
I just wanted to comment on that. I heard you talking about that one time, that codependents see everything as a problem first.
Mm-hmm.
And you described why you didn't go skiing for 2 years, and I got it. I hadn't been skiing in 3 years
mm-hmm.
for exactly the same reasons.
It's too cold, too crowded, and too much
to wait in line, and mm-hmm. I don't want to rent those skis. And instead of thinking of coming down the mountain and and playing tapes and loving the I'm thinking about all the things that you have to do.
I have my own codependency. I've given up a lot of the joys of life because I see the problems with achieving that joy. And I started to lose it. And in fact, the progression of that is that the codependent becomes phobic. They get afraid of socializing, afraid of driving, afraid of leaving the house, afraid of people. And the phobias build in the chronic stages of codependency.
Is that like stages? We talk about stages of alcoholism. Mm-hmm. We just have a few minutes, but have you got some quick guidelines on that, like where someone could identify where they were?
As far as the stages of codependency, when the phobias are there, you're moving towards acute and chronic. Most of us are in the escalation stages, where we're, like trying to escalate and de-escalate. We'll try a program, a recovery event, we'll have an affair, we'll do something to try to break up the enmeshment, we'll try to separate somehow. But without dealing with the core of our codependency, our own feelings and what happened to us in our childhood, I think we're going to just stay escalating and de-escalating until it becomes acute and chronic. The key about dealing with addiction, to me, is dealing with the beginnings of addiction, the beginning stages, which are always the initiation and the establishment of the addiction in our lives. And that's always about abuse, neglect, abandonment, or enmeshment.
Okay.
And those are the keys.
And I want people to hear that we're going to be talking about that next week, and Terry's going to be on the program talking about the very thing you just mentioned of how do we go about in the process that you've developed in New Family Life workshops and helping people to get back into where they got initiated into compulsivity or codependency or people addiction or whatever we're going to call it.
I think the final answer to whether you are codependent or not is if you're drowning and you see someone else's life flash before your eyes.
Oh, that is fantastic. Well, that's beautiful. I remember that. What about adult children of alcoholics? And I mean, a lot of people are going there now who are not adult children of alcoholics but recognize that they're codependent.
Mm-hmm. I think that the program it seems to be, in most places, a pretty open program. And I think the 12-step recovery program for addiction is the best possible recovery program to work. But the other part is that that's not therapy. That doesn't deal with the system. And it doesn't, part of what therapy does is help us deal with the reality of our lives. And part of what the 12-step program does is keep continuing, expanding on that reality and increasing the depth of our souls and spirituality.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about that next week, talking about the process. The next program is on Help for the Family, and I plan to talk about 12-step programs. I really don't know that anybody's talked about this very much on television, mm-hmm. where people really understand how potent a 12-step program is, although with the modification that you just gave. Because I got rid of my alcohol. I didn't drink alcohol, but I hadn't dealt with the setups for my compulsivity.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what you're saying, that you have to deal with the setups for the compulsivity.
Right. I had to look at, when I came home, I was always reacting to the unpredictable, the unmanageable, the potential violence or anger or depression in my family, and not reacting to myself. And until I saw that that was the beginning of my codependency, and that it was my survival, and it was my friend, I was always struggling with my codependency. Once I stopped the struggle, I could become the codependent and begin a recovery process for it.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Terry, I really appreciate you being on tonight, and I really appreciate knowing you're going to be on next week, and that you're going to go through the thing that you've developed yourself in terms of showing people a way to go back into their family systems and work through some of these setups. And I just think you're doing pioneering work, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate you being here.
Well, thank you, John. I really enjoyed the show so far, too. Well,
thank you. Okay. Folks, what I want to do is just give you a couple of things in conclusion. The idea of not having my own reality, that is, giving up my own feelings, my own needs, my own thoughts, my own wants, which is what the core, as Terry has pointed out, the core of this problem is, that I don't live out of my own reality. I don't have a reality. I live off of other people's reality. To me, that is exactly what I talked about in the first program. There's only one sorrow, the sorrow of not being a saint. That is, being the one you were meant to be, missing the mark, and living your life and going to your death and never knowing who you are. Somebody once said you could go back 5,000 years and you 5 million years and you'd never find anybody like you. Or you could go forward 5 million years and you'd never find anyone like you. But there never has been anyone like you. And the tragedy is that we go to our death never knowing the difference that makes the difference. My friend Mike Falls, an Episcopal priest, gave me a quote. I think it's Thoreau. He said, there is nothing so rare as an act of your own. Now, when I think about that, that is just awesome to me. I wanted to read you one final thing. This is from a book called Advice from a Failure by Jo Cordere, and it really sums it up. She says, you do not need to be loved, not at the cost of yourself. The single relationship that is truly central in a life is a relationship with yourself. It is rewarding to find someone you like, but essential to like yourself. It is quickening to recognize that someone is a good and decent human being, but it's indispensable to view your own self that way. It is a delight to discover people who are worthy of respect, admiration, and love, but it's vital to believe yourself deserving of respect, admiration, and love. For you cannot live in someone else. Listen to this. Of all the people that you will ever know in a lifetime, you are the only one that you will never lose or leave. To the question of your life, you're the answer. And to the problems of your life, you're the solution. To me, that sums it up. I have treasured that quotation, that of all the people that I will ever know in my whole life, I am the only one that I'll never leave or lose. And so if I don't have a relationship with me, how could I possibly have a relationship with anybody else? You know, I say to people, would you go to a motel with you this weekend? I mean, do you love yourself? Do you care enough about yourself? And yet we'd ask someone else to. So that's the relationship that we need to focus on, is that relationship with ourselves. Thank you.